Welcome to Risk Revolution, a podcast series that examines all aspects of risk management in the life sciences industry. We'll talk to industry experts on best practices for identifying risk, assessing risk, measuring solutions, implementing solutions, and monitoring results. Here are your hosts, Nuala Callan, Valerie Mulholland, and Lori Richter.
Well, welcome back to Risk Revolution, our monthly series seeking to advance the maturity of risk management practices right across the life science sector. We always cover topics that challenge professionals within the biopharmaceutical and medtech industries, and we aim to shake up the paradigm to revolutionize ways in which we perceive and perhaps most importantly, proactively manage risk. And for episode 36, here we are in Val's home territory. We're live from the ISPE Ireland affiliates Inspire event in Cork. And we have had a great morning so far listening to some of the leading manufacturing operations in Ireland talking about facility design, ATMPs, impact of AI on our sector, among many other topics. And here attending the conference today is Richard Denk, who is a senior consultant in aseptic processing and containment at Scan AG and has a deep involvement in both ISPE and PDA in terms of Annex 1, isolators, ATMPs and containment communities. And he has written and presented extensively on isolator design, isolator operation, robotics and aseptic manufacturing facility design. So when we heard that Richard was here, we pounced on the opportunity to grab Richard and invite him onto the pod. And Val is here with me also, but it's way too early for Lori, who's still in bed in California. So we'll catch up with Lori later on her reflections. So Val, have you had time to wander around the amazing exhibit hall here with hundreds of exhibitors by the look of it? And a careers fair. What has struck you so far, Val?
Absolutely. Welcome to everybody. Welcome to our podcast listeners as well. You know, events like this are always amazing, but this one is spectacular. There are just so much going on here. And the whole buzz and the networking, I've met so many people that I haven't met for ages. It's great. And the chats and the discussions. And, you know, we really get to exchange our views. And this pod session hopefully is no different because, as you say, we have Richard here. And I don't think there are many people with the same insight into risk management and Annex 1 and contamination control strategies and containment as Richard does. So there you go. Welcome. Do you want to give a boula basta welcome? Richard first. Thank you. And before we start the science proper, Richard, this is not your first trip to Cork, though. You have actually been here before, and I believe you even kissed the Blarney Stone. And I believe you didn't do a risk assessment before you did it, because it's a bit of a dodgy.
Yes, it's not my first time here, and thank you for being here with both of you on the stage. So for this podcast, actually I was here 1995, first time. In Ireland. And if I would have done a proper risk assessment, would I at that time not even known what a risk assessment is? And most probably have never been to the stone because it would have really started Schuller Drive, my first time on the left side. Yeah. And I managed it from Dublin to get here, you know, at that time was it more challenging to drive than nowadays. But I did, and I did it actually twice.
Oh,
yeah, right. Because I thought I needed, you know. Yeah. And then the only risk assessment, or I remember, as we every day do risk assessments in on all of what we are doing, I was standing there and I said, Schuller, and I was afraid of height, you know. I must always say, will I really do this in front of us, turn around, lay down, go back underneath and kiss it? But I was in Ireland at the time to practice to speak English. You know, I'm born and raised in Bavaria, countryside, farming, no English. At school, we have what did we have in English? Was almost nothing. And growing up at the time, it was also not that we are used to speak, you know. As I were a child, I was told when I'm allowed to speak, you know. As in that time. So I needed it. I thought I have to kiss the stone. So whatever risk would appear, it doesn't matter to me. I needed it desperately and I did it, you know. And actually I thought I'd have to do it twice, but this was a journey, yeah.
You didn't know they were going to dangle you backwards off the top of a castle, I think. For anybody who's never kissed it, it's pretty dodgy.
So listen, Richard, I know from my own work across EU and US sites that despite the fact that Annex 1 has been officially with us since August 2022, although I feel like I've grown up with this Annex 1, it's been so long in coming, and in fact in operation since August 2023, and as I say, the expectations were well flagged in draft form before that, but still I'm finding many parental sites still have a way to go in terms of complying with the regulation. So to get us started, perhaps you could give our listeners a very brief overview of Annex 1 and more importantly, focus on where, in your view, companies are currently at in terms of their implementation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the journey started already around 2013, 2014, where the initiative was done that the previous one should be updated, you know. And then was the industry some kind of surprised as then in just before Christmas 2017, 21st of December, then the draft was published. And everybody thought maybe there were some updates, but not an almost complete rewrite of the document. Yeah, and then you all know the journey. Then was Brexit, and everything took then longer. And then it was sent over to France to finalize the document. And then we have a lot of member states, you know, all of them have to agree. Finally, on the Annex 1, it was a long journey, yeah. The industry could provide feedback. In the second draft, and was only sent out to specific stakeholders like ISP and PDA. I was in the ISP commenting group at the time. And then it was published. And then it starts some kind of silence, let's say it like this, you know. We had also in the ISP, the former 4.0 Annex 1 conference. We then decided after a couple of years, we only go former 4.0 because what can come new on Annex 1, you know? So I remember somebody asked me, said, Richard, why do you focus all the time on Annex 1? There is not really so interest in it. Everybody knows. And then I said to him, look, give us a year. And then when all of the inspections coming, and then let's talk again. And then it was a big wake up to the industry. And every week, another warning letter, another observation where they found this one. And at the moment, the industry is really scared. Also implementing new things, not only old. So legacy facilities to update. What is the right approach to do this? Because of all of those weekly new information, what we get. And I would say there is far away to go. And then as we were isolated, let's say, from this former 4.0 Annex 1, and then I initiated, I say, look, we need a dialogue. We need a dialogue between the industry and the regulators. Otherwise, we will not come to a way that we can really say we come to a harmonization. And then was 1.5 years back, this Annex 1 symposium born, the first one in Italy last year in Florence. And there we started a different way of, let's say, of a conference style, going away from just presentation to a workshop with the dialogue, direct dialogue to the regulators and ask them about feedback. And by the way, it's a 5 affiliate joint symposium where Ireland, I'm back again to Ireland, you know. So the DACH, Germany, Austria, Switzerland, the Nordic, France and Italy. And next week we have the Annex 1 Symposium Lyon, and those who were selected most, what they want to discuss is exactly on our workshop topic, filling line setup, because this is so much to discuss right now. And that's been discussed and also with the regulators in the town hall.
Yeah. And I mean, right up until 2 weeks ago, we're still seeing warning letters for legacy facilities coming out extensively, spelling out all of the shortcomings that are still, still in place out there. So there is quite a ways to go. And I think, we have seen a big uptick in terms of how people are developing their CCSs and getting the paperwork right and getting their people in place. But then we see a shortfall in the implementation in terms of the environmental monitoring, in terms of the oversight, in terms of the risk-based approaches and decision-making that's occurring out of that. So I'm sure we'll get to talk about all of that as we go along. Val, did you have something from a poll that might get us started?
We did. Before we came on air, we did some polls with the audience, and we just want to share some of those results with Richard so he might comment on them. So the first poll we asked people is, which best describes your site's Annex 1 position today? Now, there were a number of people in the room for which it wasn't relevant, and we'd expect that. But for those that were, I think we're seeing the majority of people do have a CCS, a contamination control strategy, in place. It's active. They're using it in their change management system, their deviation system. They're using it to inform their review process. But we equally have a bunch of people who, about 20%, who have a CCS, but it's mostly a document map. Does that surprise you, Richard, or is that kind of consistent with what you're seeing across the board? Or
so for those who voted not applicable, I can let you know there is something mentioned in Annex 1, which also says it might be applicable for non-sterile products. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so be aware. We also discussed this right now for other areas. The reason why this was coming in the development of the Annex 1, this contamination control strategy, is something what the regulators would like to see in other areas in the same way. So the Annex 1 was here, the first document published from the European Commission, then global with PICS and WHO. And when you look about the current revision of part 4 for ATMPs, they also mentioned already from the EMA, European Commission, that contamination control strategy will be implemented the same as it is right now in PIX Annex 2A. So for those who think maybe it's not applicable, you should be a little bit careful about that. Maybe it's similar, the same as many said, we have always produced this kind of sterile product the last 10, 20 years very successfully, but we need a new Annex 1, until what then was here, that we are facing continuously observations, CCS. I have a little bit of feeling with the CCS. It remembers me the time where qualification and validation was also new. So it's not that long time ago, not as of maybe for some of you, it's a long time back, but it's not that long time. It was happening after my first trip to Cork. And I think around 2000, beginning of 2000, this qualification and validation was coming up. And there also the industry was not sure how to provide and validation master plan at the time, how to do risk assessment. As I said, I was not aware 1995 about risk assessment. And this is also something where I face a little bit now, and also the regulators have also not a clear strategy how a really holistic contamination control should look like and what they would like to what they wanted to see in this document. In general, it should not be a document with 450 pages on a risk assessment, where there is not an oversight on it, and where is not really a living document. This is exactly that what they told us, that they want to see this as a living document, because nobody would think it's written in stone when we come back to the stone again. And that's what was told, because I was mentioned to in ISP, but also in PDA. In PDA, we have right now settled a group on implementation contamination control strategy. You know, there is the technical report 90, is the House of Contamination Control. But there is now under revision that we will implement also how a contamination control should looks like to provide more guidance to the industry.
Yeah, and I agree with you. It has to be a living document, because as new knowledge arises in the adoption of these practices, and as new information occurs and data and trends arise from the EM program, you've got to address that and look back and say, well, what assumptions did we make that are not still standing up, or maybe our controls are not as robust as we had initially assumed when we were sitting in the back room doing the risk assessment. So it does have to be a living document. And that's, I think, one of the key things to take away is that, it's, as you say, it's not cast in stone.
And maybe I can add something what you said, and the trending.
Yes.
You mentioned the trending, and that is also something what was clear mentioned, you know. With the trendings, the regulators would like to see already beforehand if there could be something happen. A contamination control strategy should be designed that you identify the risk of contamination already before it happens. And not that you identified it and then come with a kappa. So yeah. It should not happen that you identify something. Yeah,
absolutely. Val, what about our next question from our poll? What have we got there?
Well, I suppose we were interested in, I'll just move that on, how often people actually go to the process when they're doing risk assessments, and how, down there in the operation where we look at what is actually happening. And we're getting about 27% people saying sometimes, and 24% saying almost always, and a further 20% maybe only after a deviation, or if we've a finding that we're going checking something out. And then, just under 20 rarely. So it's a kind of a split vote there for sure. Yeah, any reflections on that?
Yeah. So last year we did an Annex 1 workshop in Dublin. And there we discussed such kind of risk assessment progress. The challenge is, you have a diverse team to write this risk assessment. Most probably, a set is maybe hundreds of pages. On the other hand, you have operators, and they have never seen that risk assessment, for instance. And this is the big risk in overall, because you identify hundreds, thousands of risks, but your operators are not aware about those risks. Most probably the most of them, what they have decided that they have not even seen. But they have to take care that this risk does not happen, because sure, you can control a lot of risk with monitoring implementation and other things, But in the end, it's the operators, and they must be aware what are the risks and how they have to be very careful about that. Not that this risk ends up in quality issues of the product. Yeah.
Yeah, so just my comment on this, I mean, as you say, we pretty much have a four-way split here. And sometimes is not the right answer. You need to involve those frontline people. And this goes right across for all our risk assessments that we do. Very often, Val and I work in this area all the time, and somebody hears that there's a risk assessment that they've been invited to, and they're thinking, well, there's 3 or 4 days of my life I'm never getting back. And how can I get out of it? And more importantly, it's happening in an offline capacity, not in an online capacity. And we often don't have those frontline people who are responsible for their behaviors, particularly when it comes to the contamination control strategy, the behaviors of the operators and the frontline team are so critical to the execution of that control strategy. And, you know, looking at a floor plan layout or a material waste and personnel flow in 2D or even in 3D, if you've got all sorts of high-tech CAD opportunities, is not the same as going down and physically walking the site. And I do appreciate that, you know, in certain instances, it's not always easy to do that because we are talking about aseptic facilities and the whole garbing and et cetera. But it's absolutely critical that the people who are involved, the risk owners and the leads for that area, are involved in going down to observe the physical constraints that are in the areas sometimes, particularly when all the equipment and the materials are there and all the personnel are there. So we're a great believer in Gembas. Go to Gemba, go involve the front line. And if you don't do that, we can't assume that our SOPs or our procedures or our batch records are going to somehow confer via osmosis the knowledge of where the risk controls are to our operating and frontline teams. So really, really important. It's something Val and I regularly talk about on the pod.
Yeah, absolutely. Because, you know, although, you know, to be more optimistic about it, I find when I'm in companies doing audits and you go into areas and you ask people in the area to describe the risks and where they lie and, you know, and contamination risks, they mightn't have seen the risk assessment, but I do think in general, most people are aware and, you know, it is something that is discussed. And, you know, I certainly find in the operations I go into that's, you know, there is an awareness there, which is maybe great. But still, I mean, the whole area, there's lots of challenges. So we ask people about, you know, the common weaknesses in risk-based approaches. And again, we have an interesting spread of results here. So we have, the most popular comment here was that controls are listed in the risks and risk assessments, but our evaluating them for effectiveness maybe isn't happening as often as we'd like. Perhaps our cross-functional ownership is weak. And sometimes alternative approaches are justified, but not strongly evidenced. Controls are listed, but not evaluated for effectiveness. Richard, your thoughts?
Yeah. So, is cross-functional ownership? This is also something what I often hear from regulators, this whole holistic view on a CCS. Not looking in silos, you know, which has often happen that you have areas where that person is responsible, like for training of operators, for facility design, for monitoring, whatever, you know. So that there is an oversight, when it's also actually mentioned in Annex 1. The quality oversight, but also that this quality oversight. So when I would come and would visit you, and I have started GMP auditing many years back in my second life, you know, I started as a, maybe I have not explained it, I started a mechanical engineer. So I know exactly how to design equipment. I wrote also a book about hygienic design, but I also started in later in quality control, auditing, all of that. What is then to that related? And I actually wanted to see also such kind of an oversight view on it, that people, this person goes also into manufacturing and look how the processes are performed. And not only for that, was the training okay, you know, or is the EM monitoring okay, that he has really an overview on everything. And coming back again to Ireland, because I'm here and love this country. So I think it's so similar, the area as I grew up in Bavaria. So, and that's what we have also seen in this Annex 1 workshop, you know, that this is not common practice. And I said, as I grew up in a countryside around farming, you know, not known anything, my first time in Las Vegas, and I was so fascinated that on hotels where they have 10,000 bedrooms, and every bed looks the same, you know, perfectly done, and everything is exactly positioned. And I told them, the people, how does this happen, or how do they make it? Because they have a quality oversight. And this quality oversight walked to the facility, to the hotel, the whole day and checked that everything is worked out perfectly. And this is actually, that's what I would expect from you when I come, you know, that you have this overview, that you look at the people. Because sometimes when I'm visiting companies, people do failures, not on purpose. They forget it, or they have too much stress. And that's you have also to consider. You have to consider in your risk assessment also that operators could make failures as they have too much to do, you know? Is the work what the operators have to do, is this based this a risk? And I often do not see this, you know? When I look in a risk assessment, I never see the operators, you know? Well, in Annex 1, is it mentioned that the operator is the highest source of contamination risk to the sterile product?
Yeah, it's a good perspective because, I mean, you know, it is hard working in clean rooms. You know, it is a hard job. Actually, I might just segue into Q&A here for a minute because thanks to our audience, they're feverishly and beaverishly typing questions into the Q&A as well.
Okay.
Oh, they are. And in case we run out of time, I might pounce on a couple of them that are kind of fitting in with what you're saying there. For example, somebody's asking, you know, what are the biggest challenges for firms trying to strike a balance between compliance and operational agility?
Mm-hmm. Mm. So, shall I tell you what? When I could create the words of the year, I would say what I hear most from regulators, what they say in the meantime, design it out. Don't perform a huge risk assessment when you can design this out. And they have seen it somewhere that our organization have done it. They expect from you the same. So, and that is quite important also to be always so in this balance, what is possible. And this is also what I would like to see in a risk assessment. When you say, when you make, for instance, a gap analysis risk assessment, you know, Annex 1 was coming out, you should have a gap analysis. What was before and what is new and where are your gaps? And I would not like to see that you write in your strategy, we have put a barrier, for instance, around, but no gloves inside because we cannot reach this area. Then I would like to know, why can you not reach that area and why couldn't not design it out? And never say, because of cost. This is that what you should not use. But yeah.
As you're talking about design, I mean, another audience member is asking, you know, what is the sweet spot for balancing risk versus innovation opportunities? Because, I mean, these are high-risk environments and, you know, we do try to be very cautious.
Yeah.
But, you know, of course, technology and innovation is there to design it out, as you say.
Exactly. Yeah. That's just really what this and the latest, I do not mention here the latest one because we are facing also, as I mentioned at the beginning, when I would have done an appropriate risk assessment, I would never have kissed the stone.
Hmm.
Yeah. And when we can also dive so much in any risk where have never been a risk before, that we end up not manufacturing sterile products anymore.
Hmm.
And there we have to find a really good balance on that. We have not to questionize everything what worked before in a validated and an approved way and say, now you think based on a risk assessment, it does not work any longer in that way because we end up in not manufacturing medicines.
Yeah, and I just concur with that, because one of the other models that we would use regularly is, you know, the hierarchy of risk controls, which is based on the safety industry, you know, from OSHA and others. And of course, exactly as the regulators are saying, design it out. The first principle of a risk control is, can you eliminate it? Mm-hmm. And if you can't eliminate it through design, can you substitute it with a lower risk opportunity? And if you can't substitute it, then, you know, and you automate it. And really, we should only be looking at, you know, putting in practices or procedural and administrative controls at the very, very end, where we're relying on operators to try and do something that, you know, it was the system or the facility or the equipment was never designed to do. And what I see still is a huge effort goes into justifying why, or writing a white paper on why they can put this, they're not designing something out. And if they put the same level of effort into designing it out in the first place, rather than justifying, using a risk-based approach to justify their current practice. And I would just caution anybody listening or here in the room, stop using the word justify in you know, a justification report or a white paper. You're already putting a red rag to the bull. Now we have the terminology from ICHQ 9R1 where they say make a risk-based decision. So entitle your report, if you have to, a risk-based decision report based on the following problem and how we're planning to solve it. But that design it out, which is eliminate or substitute or reduce the risk in some way, is always a better way to go. Well, where are we on the next poll?
Well, you see, you segues nicely into it, because we mightn't use the word justification, but we do have to establish the effectiveness of our programs. So we asked people, you know, where they struggle defending with evidence aspects of Annex 1 or their contamination control strategy. And I think top of the pile there is the effectiveness of the contamination control strategy itself, followed by justifying, I can't use that word, you told me, interventions and aseptic behaviours. And thirdly, I suppose the challenges designing and trending and what we do in response to environmental monitoring programs and what they discover. Do those trends surprise you, Richard, or is that what you see? Or
so in general, that CCS is always on top. You also see in Arthuris there was here such Annex 1.
So how do you go about demonstrating the effectiveness of the CCS then?
But I think that, let me check the heart as well. So intervention, aseptic behaviors, yeah. Interventions are always something. What has, coming back to a risk assessment, design it out, you know. This is also something what I often hear, you know. Interventions all over is critical, you know. And this is very challenging to defend, because you have then really the access. And hopefully you do not with open door interventions, you know, you're already at that stage that you have already a barrier in use. What is interesting is that it varies also from region to region, what the industry is good answering there, because I think Ireland is already ahead maybe of many others, you know. You were coming into that industry in a way where already advanced technology were on the market and they were implemented. You are not so facing then in other areas in Europe where they have facilities where the sterile manufacturing have no barrier, you know. Here you have already implemented barrier system. So that's the reason why maybe barrier technology is here at the end. Where in other applications, when I go, for instance, to Asia, when we do there was an Annex 1, it looks completely differently, you know. Or when you go into South America, where you rely even the most of them also on curtains.
But in terms of effectiveness, if you're not monitoring the effectiveness of your contamination control strategy, then it's just paper.
Exactly.
It's just a wish list. It's an aspiration. The whole purpose of writing the strategy in the first place is to be able to demonstrate that your current set of risk controls are are doing what they're intended to do. So you've got to have monitoring programs, your trending, your analysis, your review of root causes for deviations, looking at the effectiveness of your CAPAs, any changes that are going in. These are the ways in which you can demonstrate evidence that your current set of risk controls as set out in your contamination control strategy are working. And certainly it's not just in terms of, you know, finding a problem with an OOS on a sterility test at the end. That's not where you want to be discovering that you've had a loose control. What's next, Val?
I can't believe we're almost out of time. You know, so but there are a few audience questions that I think touch on things we did want to talk about, which are the potential downsides or upsides of automation and robotics. We are getting some questions around that. And also about continuous particle monitoring. So maybe we could put those to Richard.
Yeah. Robotics, for those who knows me, they know already that I have also founded a robotic group in 2019, where we have our annual workshop about robotics and AI called. The next one is in end of September. 3-day workshop where we have there at where we are at Takeda in Zurich. So we have 2 days where we also discuss with the regulators about robotics, and the 3rd day is about the Robotic Application of the Year award. I highly encourage people to get there, because even myself, I'm every year surprised what's there going on automation. Unbelievable, you know, from companies I have not even heard before, which design complete, fully automated system. But it is also a challenging area, you know. On the other hand, I see specifically in aseptic manufacturing a lot of failures done in aseptic with robots, where the robots cross critical areas. And you always have to imagine a robot is nothing, it's the same as you would the operator hand with the glove would perform this. And the operator with the gloves, as the gloves are not seen as sterile, are not allowed to cross critical areas. So the robot is also not allowed, you know, and the robot could generate turbulences. When the design is done appropriately, then it's a really good technology. And then it can also support this continuous monitoring, because often the continuous monitoring is stopped because of the intervention that have to be done. And then the machine is stopping. You have to replace saddle plates, you know, and this is also such a topic which is mentioned from the beginning of Annex 1, 2017 version, continuous monitoring, you know. And there, I think I hope also from my side that we see there more of those improvements. And this is the reason why I have initiated this group. And I said, for those who are enthusiastic in robotics, please come. You will be surprised what you will see there. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah, well, the future lies there for sure. I'm just going to put one more question to you before we finish up. Mm-hmm. I can't believe the time went so fast.
Then ask me one about containment.
Well, that was what I was going to ask you. Go on, say a few words about containment before we finish.
Yeah, because it was mentioned in the morning in this first session here from IT, where the industry is heading also in Ireland, where they say they go more in ADCs, they go more in bio manufacturing with more potent products with biosafety level 1 or a biosafety level 2 products. And this is, I always say, we have the world championship on soccer, not in Europe, unfortunately. But the thing is, you know, I always say when you have aseptic and high potent or aseptic and high biosafety level, then you really go into the Champions League, because there you have to provide operator protection in a positive environment. And one thing what I wanted to tell you, what I learned on containment, this is that where I was coming from, or my nickname, Mr. Containment, is coming from as I introduced this into the world. Everybody tells you, I can do Annex 1. everybody tells you, I can do extremely potent substance. But in the end, you have to justify this in front of the inspector and not the company who maybe tells you this. Always look in the detail. Always look what they tell you and always look about gaps maybe they might have according to the risk assessment. And now you can hopefully ask the last question.
I'll ask you the last question because this was clearly posed by a cynic. Is there any actual data to show that the impact of Annex 1 is having an effect on patient safety, improved quality?
So when you speak about the regulated risk, question. It is. Yeah, it has. I was last year invited from the MHRA and HPRA to do a full-day training on an Annex 1, specifically on specific topics. And there was mentioned that there is a big diversity, you know. As mentioned before, there is areas where they have curtains, but some have not even have curtains around, you know. On others area, they are high developed, like when you go to Ireland. And this is also what they see. They go in areas where they see different quality and different, maybe, risk assessments. And this is where they have to find a way to make this. And when you ask them, they would say yes. But it really depends on the region or also on the or on the product they manufacture.
I think we've had some fantastic insights there, both from shared from the audience in terms of how you've done your polling and from your fantastic responses, Richard. I think that's pretty much a wrap for our live podcast session today here from ISPE Inspire. I'm certainly inspired after that. Big thank you to you, Richard, for joining us and generously giving of your time to be here with us today. As usual, we'll be back next month with our usual range of topics and a mix of guest interviews. And I think our book club is coming up.
Yes, next episode of the book club.
Where we'll share some of our favourites in terms of authors and books in the area of critical thinking, risk science, leadership, human behaviour, and in search of learning how we can strengthen our risk-based approaches to better assure product availability. So please do subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And new episodes will appear miraculously into your feed. Finally, what do we have in the show notes this week?
I think we'll give the results of the polls in the show notes. Folks, thanks for coming and joining us in the room here. Big thank you. Big clap, hand clap to Richard. And we'll see you all next month. Bye from Val.
Goodbye from Nuala.